1950, almost precisely 2 weeks after Acheson praised Hiss, McCarthy gave his Wheeling, West Virginia speech. The idea that there was nothing going on and McCarthy burst onto the scene like the Terminator is preposterous. Journalist David Frum has written that the country did not need McCarthy to convince it that the Soviet Union and its domestic sympathizers were a threat that had to be repulsed. At the time, even people who were not fans of McCarthy did not take such a rosy view. In 1953, at the height of McCarthy's reign of terror, political philosopher Sidney Hook wrote that the United States was the chief remaining obstacle to world domination by the Soviet Union. And yet, he said, viewing the Kremlin's assault on the United States, matters are growing worse. Whitaker Chambers said that when he left the Communist Party, he was leaving the winning side for the losing side. Communist infiltration, he said, had achieved its ultimate purpose. In a situation with few parallels in history, the agents of an enemy power were in a position to influence the nation's foreign policy in the interests of the nation's chief enemy. And not only on exceptional occasions like Yalta, but in what must have been the staggering sum of day-to-day decisions. In America's battle to save itself, Chambers could name only a few sparse victories. Among them was the indictment of a Soviet spy at the Commerce Department, William Remington. In McCarthy's enumeration of security risks in the government, Remington was case number 19. The liberal establishment reacted to Soviet spies swarming through the government with the gentle protective attitude of an Oxford don towards Soviet agents like Kim Philby. It was simply a prerogative of the old WASP ruling class to harbor Soviet spies. It was on the spectrum of things young people did. Some of their young men would grow up to be poets, and some would grow up to be Bolsheviks. McCarthy exposed the moral corruption of the entire liberal ruling class. Salon liberals foolishly indulged their infatuation with communism to the peril of the country. Even the Hiss case had failed to rouse the Democrats. The Brahmin's true indignation was reserved for a low-born bum like Chambers who dared attack Hiss. With his Supreme Court clerkship, his hauteur, his good breeding, his Bryn Mawr-educated wife, Priscilla. The Democratic Party defended Alger Hiss and then brushed it off as a mere nothingness. They would have gotten away with it, too, but for McCarthy. McCarthy came out swinging and created horrendous fear among the Soviet apparatchiks and their champions in the Democratic Party. Dean Acheson, with his fake British accent, his Groton and Yale degrees, was one of McCarthy's favorite targets. He had no use for mincing Ivy League diplomats with communist partisans on their staff. A half century later, when the only people who call themselves communists are harmless cranks, it is difficult to grasp the importance of McCarthy's crusade. But there's a reason communist now sounds about as threatening as monarchist. McCarthy made it a disgrace to be a communist. Domestic communism could never recover. The big argument against McCarthy is that the whole notion of communist subversion was a joke. It was not a joke. It was real. And the Democrats didn't care. In the 20th century, nearly 100 million people were murdered in the name of communism. Stalin held his monstrous Soviet show trials, committed genocide against the kulaks, and created a forced famine for the Ukrainians when they resisted collectivization. There was Mao's Great Leap Forward, murdering tens of millions of people. There was the Khmer Rouge's massacre of one quarter of the entire Cambodian population. Communist mass murder not only predated the Nazi variety, but far surpassed it. Wherever there was communism, there was repression, torture, and mass murder. It is a fact that hundreds of agents of this blood-soaked ideology became top advisors to Democratic presidents, worked on the Manhattan Project, infiltrated every segment of the United States government. Stalin's agents held top positions in the White House, the State Department, the Treasury Department, the Army, and the OSS. Because of Democrat incompetence and moral infirmity, all Americans lived under the threat of nuclear annihilation for half a century. As Soviet spies passed nuclear technology to Stalin, President Roosevelt gave strict orders that the OSS engage in no espionage against the country ruled by his pal, Uncle Joe. When it could have been stopped, when days after the Hitler-Stalin pact was signed, an ex-communist came to the United States government and informed on Hiss, as well as dozens of other Soviet spies in the government. President Roosevelt had laughed. McCarthy punched back so hard, liberals are still reeling. Chapter 3. No communists here. A typical account of the McCarthy era is given in the 1978 book, The Great Fear, by David Kott. As the title suggests, the book portrays a period much like Stalin's Great Terror, only worse. It seems a baseless, sweat-drenched fear of communists seized America during the 50s. Kott writes, "There is no documentation in the public record of a direct connection between the American Communist Party and espionage during the entire post-war period. Even before Soviet cables proved the existence of a vast Soviet-run espionage network in America, there was lots of evidence. There were, for example, the detailed accounts given in sworn testimony by various ex-communists like Whitaker Chambers, Elizabeth Bentley, and Louis Boudens. There were Chambers' pumpkin papers. There were Soviet defectors who brought reams of KGB documents with them, identifying Soviet agents in America. There were confessions of arrested spies, such as David Greenglass, who informed on his sister Ethel Rosenberg and her husband Julius. There was the arrest of Judith Copland, who was actually apprehended in the act of handing a U.S. counterintelligence file to a KGB officer. No evidence. It turned out that, all along, there was also evidence in the form of decrypted Soviet cables to their agents in America. Though not revealed for half a century, the U.S. government had broken the Soviet cable code beginning in the 40s in a top-secret undertaking known as the Venona Project. In the most patriotic act of his career, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan would push through the declassification of the Venona Project, which was finally unveiled on July 11, 1995. After the cables were revealed, liberals became a little less argumentative about evidence of Soviet spies. Here was enough evidence, even for those who demand a shockingly high level of proof before defending America. The Venona Project was begun in 1943 by Colonel Carter Clark, chief of the U.S. Army Special Branch, in response to rumors that Stalin was negotiating a separate peace with Hitler. Only a few years earlier, the world had been staggered by the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Unaccountably, Colonel Clark did not share President Roosevelt's trust in a man FDR called Uncle Joe. Cloaked in secrecy, Clark set up a special army unit to break the Soviet code. Neither President Roosevelt nor President Truman was told about the Venona Project. This was a matter of vital national security. The Democrats could not be trusted. The Soviets used a code that was, in theory, unbreakable. But by the war's end, the Americans had cracked it. And when the Venona cryptographers read the Soviet cables, they discovered something far more sinister than Stalin's war plans. The Roosevelt administration was teeming with paid agents of Moscow. Stalin's handmaidens held strategic positions at the White House, the State Department, the War Department, the Office of Strategic Services, and the Treasury Department. To this day, only a small number of intercepted Soviet cables have been decoded. But even that much proves McCarthy was absolutely right in his paramount charge. The U.S. government had a major communist infestation problem. It is treated as a mere truism that McCarthy was reckless, made mistakes, was careless with his facts. It can now be said that McCarthy's gravest error was in underestimating the problem of communist subversion. The scale of the conspiracy was unprecedented. Hundreds of Soviet spies honeycombed the U.S. government throughout the 40s and 50s. America had been invaded by a civilian army loyal to a hostile power. There was no room for denying it. Soviet operatives were stealing technical information from atomic, military, radar, aerospace, and rocket programs. The cables revealed the code names of the spies, their technical espionage, and the secret transmission of highly sensitive diplomatic and strategic policies. McCarthy was accused of labeling anyone with liberal views a communist. As we now know, that wouldn't have been a half-bad system. Contrary to Kott's preposterous claim that communists were innocent idealists, the American Communist Party was linked to Stalin like an Al-Qaeda training camp to Osama bin Laden. As John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare wrote in their book, Venona, the American Communist Party was, quote, a fifth column working inside and against the United States in the Cold War. The cables expose beyond cavil the American Communist Party as an auxiliary of the intelligence agencies of the Soviet Union. They said, while not every American communist was a spy, hundreds were. It was a striking admission coming from Haynes and Clare. In their earlier book on American communism, they had stated matter-of-factly that, quote, few American communists were spies. The disgorging of decrypted Soviet cables forced the professors to revise that assessment. The decrypted Soviet cables indisputably proved the guilt of all the left's favorite Red Scare martyrs, Alger Hiss, Harry Dexter White, and Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Appropriately, the Soviets' code name for communist spy Julius Rosenberg was Liberal. Because of Venona, the FBI and certain top Justice Department officials were absolutely sure they were prosecuting the right people. But throughout the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, J. Edgar Hoover risked acquittal rather than reveal that the U.S. had cracked the Soviet code. Without realizing that the U.S. government had confirmed the accounts of such informers as Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley with Soviet cables, the left smeared ex-communist informers as lunatics and perverts. Now the world knew what J. Edgar Hoover knew at the time. The informers were telling the truth. Bentley had long been maligned the way liberals malign all women who cause them trouble. Known as the blonde spy queen, her testimony was roundly dismissed as the imaginings of a neurotic spinster. With flawless timing, just 1 year before the Venona Project was declassified, The Nation magazine sniffed that Bentley was hardly a reliable informant. In 1994, the moral flaws of ex-communist informants from the 50s was still a burning issue at The Nation. The magazine called Bentley an alcoholic who embraced both fascism and communism before she turned professional and converted to Catholicism. Though Bentley named nearly 150 people, The Nation said, the Bureau never corroborated her story. After 50 years on the case, The Nation could proclaim Bentley still a liar. In their definitive book about the decrypted cables, Venona, Haynes and Clare state simply, the deciphered Venona cables show that Elizabeth Bentley had told the truth. Here was the DNA evidence of communist crimes during the Cold War. But for some reason, liberals did not brandish this evidence so excitedly as they do newly discovered evidence allegedly exonerating murderers on death row. The only indication liberals have even heard of the Venona Project is that they haven't been as prolix on the subject of innocent victims of anti-communism lately. Except for a few doddering Stalinists on college faculties and at The Nation magazine, it's game over. All they can hold on to now is the slogan McCarthyism. Just don't ask for details. After all the righteous indignation at the New York Times about McCarthyism, to say nothing of that paper's vehement defense of Hiss, the Rosenbergs, Owen Lattimore, and for the record, Stalin in the classic reportage of Walter Duranty, the Venona Project might have been at least as important as the July 2001 story on how, if you don't count the military ballots, George Bush might have won Florida by only 200 votes. But when the Venona Project was declassified, revealing decades of cable traffic between Soviet espionage agents and their American spies, it was barely noticed at the Times. Fewer than a dozen Times articles have ever mentioned the Venona Project, even in passing. Not one article on Venona ever graced the front page or the op-ed page. To understand how deep were the Soviet tentacles in the Roosevelt and Truman administrations, try to imagine a parallel universe today. Paul Wolfowitz, Bush's Deputy Secretary of Defense, would be a member of al-Qaeda taking orders from Osama bin Laden. In the Cold War, that was Alger Hiss, Assistant to the Secretary of State under President Franklin D. Roosevelt, identified as a Soviet spy in Venona. The Assistant to the Secretary of the Treasury would be a member of al-Qaeda. He would be furiously employing a dozen other members of al-Qaeda at the Treasury Department. When their loyalty to America was questioned, he would leap in to defend them and save their jobs. With his secret al-Qaeda allies, he would intervene to block a crucial promised loan to Israel, while at the same time encouraging the administration to make an absurdly generous loan to Saddam Hussein. When Israel imploded, historians and experts would rush in and say no one lost Israel. Bush would then promote the assistant to run the International Monetary Fund. In the Cold War, that was Harry Dexter White, Assistant Secretary of Treasury under President Franklin D. Roosevelt, identified as a Soviet spy in Venona. White secured high-level government positions at the Treasury Department for at least 11 other Soviet agents, all named in Venona. White conspired with his fellow Soviet spies, Frank Coe and Solomon Adler, to kill a critical loan to nationalist China, while at the same time trying to persuade Roosevelt to give the Soviet Union a $10 billion loan. Despite repeated warnings from the head of the FBI that White was a Soviet agent, President Truman retained White at Treasury and then appointed him the top U.S. official at the International Monetary Fund. Bush aide Andrew Card would be a member of al-Qaeda, sent on important international missions for President Bush. In the Cold War, that was Lachlan Curry, administrative assistant to President Franklin D. Roosevelt and deputy administrator of the Board of Economic Warfare. He was identified as a Soviet spy in Venona. The assistant to CIA Director George Tenet would be a member of al-Qaeda. It would raise no eyebrows in the Bush administration that the assistant was identified as a member of al-Qaeda by an FBI informer, nor that he had honeymooned in Tora Bora. In the Cold War, that was Duncan Lee, chief of staff to the head of the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA. He honeymooned in Moscow and was identified as a Soviet spy in the sworn testimony of ex-spy Elizabeth Bentley. He was confirmed as a Soviet spy in Venona. Bush aide Karl Rove would be referred to by al-Qaeda leaders as their most valuable asset. He would push the Bush administration to sell military and industrial equipment to Osama bin Laden on a special lend-lease deal. Years later, an al-Qaeda operative would claim Rove was working for them. In the Cold War, that was Harry Hopkins, special advisor to President Roosevelt, and so described by a member of the Soviet underground, Anatoly Akhmarov. In KGB, the inside story, former KGB agent Oleg Gordievsky identified Hopkins as a Soviet agent of major significance. Dick Cheney would be starstruck by Saddam Hussein and would counsel restraint in response to Hussein's every hostile act. In the Cold War, that was Roosevelt's vice president, Henry Wallace, from 1940 to 1944, who believed, quote, America's main enemy was Churchill and the British Empire. He insisted that peace would be assured if the United States guaranteed Stalin control of Eastern Europe. When Stalin seized Czechoslovakia, Wallace sided with Stalin. When Stalin blockaded Berlin, Wallace opposed the U.S. airlift. After visiting a Soviet slave camp, Wallace enthusiastically described it as a combination TVA and Hudson Bay Company. Richard Perle, chairman of the Defense Policy Board, an advisory panel to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, would surround himself with members of al-Qaeda in and out of government. He would invariably take the position most advantageous to al-Qaeda. In the Cold War, that was Owen Lattimore, the foreign policy sage loitering around the State Department. Lattimore surrounded himself with Soviet spies, both at his think tank, the Institute for Pacific Relations, as well as his pals at the State Department, where he kept a desk and was deferred to as the wise man on China, which no one lost. The American ambassador to Iraq would heatedly deny that Saddam Hussein had gassed his own people. He would defend Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program and state that Iraq has, quote, every moral right to seek atomic bomb information, including by espionage. In the Cold War, that was Joseph Davies, a Roosevelt-appointed ambassador to the USSR, who insisted Stalin's show trials were honest searches for the truth. He told the Associated Press in 1946 that Russia, in self-defense, has every moral right to seek atomic bomb information through military espionage if excluded from such information by her former fighting allies. Gail Norton, Bush's Secretary of the Interior, would be a member of various al-Qaeda front groups, such as the Benevolence International Foundation, publicly lending her name to their events. In the Cold War, that was Harold Ickes, Roosevelt's Interior Secretary, and father of Clinton Deputy Chief of Staff by the same name. He was a member of a Stalinist front group, League for Peace and Democracy. He wrote a letter welcoming them to Washington for its fifth national gathering. In the midst of all this, President Bush would be referring to America's mortal enemy with warmth and affection, calling him Uncle Osama. In his inaugural address, Bush would explain that his posture toward al-Qaeda was, in order to make a friend, one must be a friend. In the Cold War, that was President Roosevelt, who called Stalin Uncle Joe and said of the Soviet Union in his fourth inaugural address, in order to make a friend, one must be a friend. Bush's Republican successor as president would be telling a top aide that Saddam was a fine man who wanted to do the right thing. He would write in his diary, "The Iraqis have always been our friends, and I can't see any reason why they shouldn't always be." In the Cold War, that was President Truman, who said this about Stalin in October 1945. And he wrote in his diary that the Russians have always been our friends, and I can't see any reason why they shouldn't always be. The principal difference between fifth columnists in the Cold War versus the War on Terrorism is that you could sit next to a communist on the subway without asphyxiating. The second difference is, by the end of World War II, Roosevelt's pal, Joseph Stalin, had murdered 20 million people. Even the religion of peace has not come close to that record. In far more time, Islamic terrorists of all nationalities, in all their manifestations, have not murdered even a fraction as many people. Incredibly, if Roosevelt had died 1 year earlier, the Soviet Union might have immediately gained control of the United States presidency, Treasury Department, and State Department. Soviet dupe Henry Wallace would have become president, and it is very possible that he would have made Soviet spy Harry Dexter White his Treasury Secretary and Soviet spy Alger Hiss his Secretary of State. In a formulation that would make Harvard-educated traitors titter, Joe McCarthy called it a conspiracy on a scale so immense as to dwarf any previous such venture in the history of man. A conspiracy of infamy so black that when it is finally exposed, its principles shall be forever deserving of the maledictions of all honest men. With a campaign of lies, liberals have turned McCarthy into the object forever deserving of the maledictions of all honest men. Summarizing the views of all liberals, President Truman said, "I like old Joe. Joe is a decent fellow." Not McCarthy, of course, but Stalin. Truman loathed Joe McCarthy. Just months into his presidency, Eisenhower would take the astonishing step of directing his Attorney General, Herbert Brownell, to go on national TV and announce that President Truman had appointed Harry Dexter White to be the top U.S. official at the IMF, with full knowledge that White had been reliably identified as a Soviet agent. It was a breathtaking revelation. This would be like President Bush instructing Attorney General John Ashcroft to hold a press conference announcing that President Clinton had appointed Muhammad Atta to be Secretary of the Transportation Department after being told Atta was a Muslim terrorist. Truman responded to Brownell's statement by indignantly denying he had ever seen an FBI report suggesting that White was a spy. Then the FBI produced the report. Next, Truman said he had moved White to the IMF only to get him out of the Treasury Department, expecting the FBI to continue its surveillance of White. So putting a Soviet spy in charge of the IMF was really a security measure. At least there was a good explanation. Former Senator Patrick Moynihan claims that if only Roosevelt and Truman had been told about the precise mechanics of the Venona Project, perhaps the Democrats would have finally expressed curiosity about the many Soviet spies in their employ. More likely, the Democrats would have told their Soviet pals that their cables were being read. In fact, that actually happened. The Venona Project had just gotten underway when trusted Roosevelt advisor Lachlan Curry informed the Soviets that the Americans were about to crack their code. Thanks to the Soviet work ethic, the KGB reacted by making only superficial changes to the code. Incredibly, a year later, someone in Roosevelt's White House, most likely Curry again, directed that the entire code-breaking project be stopped. The head of the Venona Project ignored the order. The problem was not that Democrats were not given sufficient proof of communist spies in their administrations. It was that they didn't give a damn. Even before the Venona Project was declassified, There were subtle clues that the Roosevelt and Truman administrations were having staffing problems. After showing up to testify before HUAC with Dean Acheson at his side, Harvard-educated Curry fled to Columbia. Frank Coe pled the Fifth Amendment when asked if he was a Soviet agent, and then escaped to Red China, where he became a top advisor to the communist government until his death. His efforts on behalf of totalitarianism were better rewarded than another Soviet spy, Noel Field, who fled to the workers' paradise in Hungary and was immediately imprisoned. With all the innocent victims of the Red Scare flinging themselves from windows in the 50s, you would think you couldn't walk down a street in Manhattan without a body falling on you. In fact, Harry Dexter White and Lawrence Dugan were the only casualties. After denying he was a Soviet spy in sworn testimony before HUAC, White had a heart attack and died. After being questioned by the FBI, Dugan fell from the 16th floor of a Manhattan building, an apparent suicide. And now we know why. They were Soviet spies and House investigators were closing in. It wasn't the Red Scare that drove them to their deaths, it was their guilt. At least they saved us the habeas petitions. Though all half-serious people knew the left's various celebrity martyrs were traitors without having to see Soviet cables, liberals would never, ever relent in their lies. Most astonishing was the left's defense of the Rosenbergs. There had been mass protests all around the world over the Rosenberg case. The communists assembled large crowds in Paris, Brussels, Rome, and all the usual hotspots. It was a real international cause célèbre. American liberals were exuberant. They had finally won recognition and support from all over the world. It was a good issue for them. The American left kept carrying on about the horrors of McCarthyism, but even their fellow communists couldn't quite work themselves into a lather over most of the horror. You mean he couldn't do screenplays under his own name and had to fire the gardener and clean out his backyard pool in Bel Air by himself? No, that is shocking. The Rosenberg case was the sort of thing Europeans could relate to, a bookish middle-aged couple sentenced to die in the electric chair, and not even allowed to do forced labor, but sent right away to some fiendish capitalist high-technology killing implement. It was also important in the background that everyone knew the Rosenbergs were Jewish. The communist message was, America is becoming a fascist police state. What better proof than the execution of a harmless Jewish couple from the Bronx? The Rosenbergs became the most compelling proof for the line that Eisenhower was turning the U.S. into a fascist state. It wasn't easy to put grinning Ike and fascism in the same sentence, unless it was to say that Ike destroyed fascism with his resolute wartime leadership. So the left held very tightly to the one piece of evidence that seemed to substantiate their crackpot vision of the 50s. If liberals ever admitted the Rosenbergs were guilty, they would have to admit that all those people protesting on their behalf and warning of impending fascist tyranny in America were total communist stooges or complete idiots. So no matter how much evidence kept rolling in, liberals clung to the theory that the Rosenbergs were innocent. Among the evidence tending to prove the Rosenbergs' guilt was the detailed confession of Ethel Rosenberg's brother, David Greenglass, implicating his sister and brother-in-law. There were the scores of eyewitnesses who painted a clear picture of a Soviet spy ring with Julius Rosenberg at its center. There was the fact that two members of the Rosenberg circle fled the country upon the Rosenbergs' arrest. And, of course, there was a unanimous jury verdict. As Rosenberg prosecutor Roy Cohn said, "To ask for any more is to ask for the impossible." In 1983, Ronald Radosh and Joyce Milton wrote a book about the case, The Rosenberg File, A Search for the Truth. They, too, had been idealists and fervent believers in the Rosenbergs' sublime innocence. And then they looked at the evidence and concluded otherwise. Indeed, so overwhelming was their case against the Rosenbergs, even OJ defender Alan Dershowitz proclaimed it definitive. Yet more evidence of the Rosenbergs' guilt appeared with the publication of Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs in 1990. The late Soviet premier gushed with praise for the Rosenbergs, saying they had provided very significant help in accelerating the production of our atomic bomb. Indeed, Khrushchev was unrestrained in his gratitude. Let this be a worthy tribute to the memory of those people. Let my words serve as an expression of gratitude to those who sacrificed their lives to a great cause of the Soviet state at a time when the U.S. was using its advantage over our state to blackmail our state and undermine its proletarian cause. The New York Times reacted to Khrushchev's stunning, if inadvertent, admission of the Rosenbergs' guilt by saying it was unlikely to settle a matter that has generated passionate books and an endless debate. Unhappy with the way the real evidence was going, in 1993 the American Bar Association staged a mock trial of the Rosenbergs and proclaimed them innocent. And then, 2 years later, the Soviet cables that had indisputably identified the Rosenbergs as spies were declassified. There wasn't much room for any more nails in the coffin of the Rosenbergs' guilt after that. And still, the evidence kept pouring in. In 1997, a former KGB colonel gave a television interview in which he identified himself as Julius Rosenberg's Soviet controller. He praised their important contributions to the USSR's acquisition of the bomb. He said, "Julius and Ethel are heroes, real heroes, and I don't want to take this story to my grave." He later boasted that the Rosenberg Network was one of the best producing groups of agents in the history of Soviet technological espionage. To this day, there are liberals who refuse to admit that Julius Rosenberg was a spy. No amount of evidence proving anyone was a Soviet spy could ever be enough. Blindingly obvious Soviet spies were treated as innocent liberals victimized by anti-communist hysteria, drummed up by Joe McCarthy. This is the atmosphere in which McCarthy's charges have been evaluated for the last half century. Chapter 4. The Indispensable Joe McCarthy. Despite the fevered associations of Joe McCarthy with Hollywood blacklists, ruined lives, destroyed reputations, broken careers, suicides, divorce, and depression, McCarthy's campaign was somewhat more limited in scope. McCarthy's contribution to McCarthyism consisted exclusively of his investigation of loyalty risks working for the federal government. He was not even particularly interested in the communists themselves. His targets were government officials charged with removing loyalty risks from sensitive government jobs. His campaign lasted only a few years, from 1950 to 1953, until liberals immobilized him in 1954 with their Army McCarthy hearings and censure investigation. He conducted his investigations from the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, the express mandate of which was, surprisingly enough, to investigate the federal government. As we now know, McCarthy was not terrorizing people purposelessly. His targets were Soviet sympathizers and Soviet spies. Liberals use animal-like logic to string together irrelevancies from Hollywood blacklisting to Alger Hiss, all under the rubric McCarthyism. It has simply become de rigueur to describe all communists as hapless victims of McCarthyism, irrespective of whether McCarthy had ever heard of them, and certainly irrespective of whether they were Soviet spies. Actual knowledge about McCarthy is a constant impediment to the urgent business of denouncing him. It is simply axiomatic that McCarthy was evil incarnate, just as it is axiomatic that all Republican presidents are stupid. In actual usage, McCarthyism means anyone looking at a liberal with a dyspeptic expression between 1930 and 1955. Just a few years ago, the New York Times gave as a crossword puzzle clue Senator McCarthy's group, for which the correct answer was supposed to be HUAC, standing for the House Un-American Activities Committee. The vigilant observer will note that the H in HUAC stands for House, House Un-American Activities Committee. McCarthy was never in the House. As his title indicates, Senator McCarthy was a senator. He hadn't the slightest connection with any of HUAC's investigations, which included probes of American Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, Alger Hiss, and Hollywood. The Times correction a few days later idiotically stated, "Joseph R. McCarthy was ideologically akin to members of the House committee, but as a senator he had no direct connection with it." Ideologically akin meaning, we hate them both. The neurotically repeated claim that McCarthy did not discover a single communist anywhere, as one massive biography of McCarthy states, is akin to the claim that Ken Starr never proved a single crime committed by Bill Clinton. Unless a liberal shouts out, "I did it," in a Perry Mason climax, liberals say conservatives have proved nothing. McCarthy forced liberals to make an accounting of themselves in full view of the American people. To defend themselves, liberals made McCarthy the issue. Ever since, he has been judged under a jurisprudence of epithets. Among the Soviet operatives in government jobs named by McCarthy were Mary Jane Keeney, Cedric Belfrage, Solomon Adler, Franz Neumann, Gustavo Duran, and William Remington, later killed with a bar of soap in prison by a patriotic inmate. All victims of McCarthyism. But it's a trap to quibble about the precise number of Soviet spies McCarthy uncovered. That wasn't his point. Only by bolderizing McCarthy's message can liberals make it look like he failed. McCarthy wasn't sleuthing for hidden communists. He wasn't J. Edgar Hoover investigating domestic espionage. His primary purpose wasn't even to expose individual communists. McCarthy was simply demanding explanations from the liberal establishment. Why were they sheltering traitors? For decades, people who should not have been allowed anywhere near a government job were strolling into sensitive positions with the U.S. government. As Soviet agents wormed their way deep into the U.S. government, loyalty boards were sipping sherry and shuffling papers. McCarthy came in with a blowtorch. As even McCarthy's critics concede, a host of other right-wing Republicans had sought to dramatize the communism issue, but only McCarthy succeeded. And McCarthy succeeded while the others did not, in part because of his thoroughgoing contempt for the rules of political controversy. It is often clucked that McCarthy could not distinguish between a Communist Party member and a Soviet spy. This is said by people who can't distinguish between a criminal offense and a fireable offense. The question wasn't simply whether people like William Remington were paid agents of Stalin. He was. The question was whether he should be working for the U.S. government. The accused weren't going to be sent to a gulag, only to private practice. It's not that complicated a point. 50 years of liberal propaganda has accustomed people to thinking of Communist Party members as lovable idealists, and the urge to fire them from government jobs as an irrational, anachronistic prejudice, much like Irish need not apply. Allowing card-carrying members of the Communist Party to handle classified material after the Alger Hiss case would be like allowing avowed members of Al-Qaeda to carry box cutters on airplanes after 9/11. As J. Edgar Hoover said of McCarthy, "Thank God somebody's doing it." One of the most Orwellian lies of the McCarthy myth is that he names names, as the slogan goes, ruining people's lives with reckless accusations. Apart from distracting questions of guilt or innocence, it is a fact that McCarthy doggedly resisted releasing anyone's name to the public. As is usually the case when liberals are the historians, the truth was just the opposite. Blinded by their own loathing, Democrats literally forced McCarthy to name names. McCarthy had raised the issue of loyalty risks working for the government, not proven cases of espionage. There are many reasons a person should not be handling classified materials, short of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he was a Soviet spy. McCarthy said he would attach names to the cases only in a closed committee hearing, but would not release names to the public because he didn't want to blacken the names of government employees who could be completely innocent. When he presented his case against the State Department on the Senate floor, for example, McCarthy described the loyalty risks anonymously as case number one, case number two, and so on. The Democrats subjected him to a barrage of catcalls and interruptions demanding that he name names. Democrat Senate Majority Leader Scott Lucas said, "I want to remain here until he names them. That is what I am interested in. Will the senator tell us the name of the man for the record? We are entitled to know who he is. I say this in all seriousness." That was one of Lucas's 61 interruptions that day. Another Democrat, Senator Withers of Kentucky, said, "I should like to ask the senator what reason he has for not calling names. Does not the senator think it would be a fine thing to let the public know who the guilty are? Is not the senator privileged?" That was one of Senator Withers' 23 interruptions of McCarthy. Despite McCarthy's repeated insistence that he would provide names only to the senators in closed session, the Democrats voted to compel him to name security risks openly, in front of the press. Before McCarthy ever named his first name, he said, "The senator from Illinois demanded, loudly, that I furnish all the names. I told him at the time that so far as I was concerned, I thought that would be improper, that I did not have all the information about these individuals. I have enough to convince me that either they are members of the Communist Party, or they have given great aid to the Communists. I may be wrong. That is why I said that unless the Senate demanded that I do so, I would not submit this publicly, but I would submit it to any committee, and would let the committee go over these in executive session. It is possible that some of these persons will get a clean bill of health. The sine qua non of McCarthyism, naming names, came about because of the Democrats' own hatefulness. Even McCarthy's most celebrated victim, Owen Lattimore, was not named publicly by McCarthy. It was liberal journalist and anti-McCarthy zealot Drew Pearson who leaked Lattimore's name to the public, the better to revile McCarthy for ruining people's reputations. Lattimore became one of the most well-compensated victims of McCarthyism. Upon being found a conscious articulate instrument of the Soviet conspiracy by a unanimous Senate committee, Lattimore was assured a spot lecturing at Harvard. It is indignantly reported that McCarthy exaggerated. His claim that Owen Lattimore was a Soviet agent, as opposed to behaved like a Soviet agent, is a hyperbole deserving of 100-year condemnation. Liberals' threshold for outrage seems to have risen a bit. McCarthy's rhetoric was mild by the standards of his time. In President Truman's 1948 campaign, he railed, "If anybody in this country is friendly to the communists, it is the Republicans." Truman also compared the Republicans to fascists. "In our time, we have seen the tragedy of the Italian and German peoples who lost their freedom to men who made promises of unity and efficiency and sincerity, and it could happen here." At least Republicans came up with new arguments in the intervening 50 years. This is still the Democrats' best argument. There is no question but that McCarthy's errors were infinitesimal compared to liberals' tear-filled testimonials to their own victimization. Roosevelt Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes summarized the period by sadly observing that if a man is addicted to vodka, he is, ipso facto, a Russian, therefore a communist. As is now indisputably proved by Soviet cables, hundreds of Stalin's agents swarmed through government jobs. Gee, it's so outrageous that McCarthy exaggerated. When questioned by the FBI in 1947, suspected spy Helen Silvermaster lamented that anyone with liberal views seemed to be called a communist nowadays. Soviet cables now prove absolutely Silvermaster was a Soviet spy, her husband Gregory was a Soviet spy, and her son was a courier for their spy ring. Her husband was literally on the payroll of Moscow and the United States government at the same time. He worked for the Board of Economic Warfare and later the War Assets Division of the Treasury Department. Among his services for the Soviet Union, Silvermaster smuggled out huge quantities of war production board data on weapons aircraft, tank, artillery, and shipping production. While working for the Roosevelt administration, Silvermaster was given a medal for his service to the USSR. He got his job at the Treasury from another Soviet agent, Harry Dexter White. When Mr. Silvermaster's loyalty was questioned by the Office of Naval Intelligence and War Department Counterintelligence, Harry Dexter White, Soviet spy, and Lachlan Curry, Soviet spy, enthusiastically vouched for his patriotism. Roosevelt's Undersecretary of Agriculture, Paul Appleby, wrote a righteous letter saying Silvermaster had been questioned simply because he happened to have been born in Russia. This was the sort of thing McCarthy was complaining about. Denouncing McCarthy is the establishment's loyalty oath. A professor who puts in a kind word for McCarthy would end his career, or spend the rest of it explaining himself. Even Haynes and Clare, the authors of Venona, utter the ritualistic malediction before cheerfully returning to identifying another 100 liberals who were Soviet spies. In one of the milder summaries of McCarthy's failings, historian Douglas Brinkley argues that McCarthy had frightened off responsible anti-communists. Brinkley cites the vast difference between responsible anti-communists of the early days of the Cold War and an unprincipled opportunistic bully like McCarthy. To be sure, there were a few genuine anti-communists among the ponderers, and they are to be commended. But the country was not in vital need of soporific academics at windbag conferences put on by the Congress for Cultural Freedom. It did not need tepid rebukes of Stalinism in Encounter magazine or cherished little homilies warning that quite noble attempts to defeat evil may, in sufficiently perverse circumstances, be mistaken for evil. What the country needed was Joe McCarthy. His appeal was directed to the mass of ordinary Americans. It's interesting that Democrats keep claiming to speak for the working man, but somehow it's always right-wing Republicans who make a direct connection to workers. What liberals mean by working families is non-families in which no one works. From McCarthy to Richard Nixon to Ronald Reagan, it is conservatives who appeal to workers. When Republicans ignite the explosive energy of the hard hats, liberals had better run for cover. McCarthy was beloved by workers. He had a gift of appealing to the great common sense of the American people. He made broad points that captured the headlines and rallied Americans. Normal Americans could not believe their fellow countrymen could be so dastardly as not to love their country. For them, McCarthy was a poet. Liberals may have written the history books, but at the time, the instinctual response of the American people prevailed over the left's theatrics. No matter how much the elites ridiculed McCarthy, lots of Americans seemed to like him. In the summer of 1951, the Truman administration planned an all-out attack on McCarthy, going directly to his base, the Veterans of Foreign Wars. At the dedication of the new American Legion building, both Truman and his not-coincidentally Catholic Labor Secretary, Maurice Tobin, gave speeches attacking McCarthy. Truman spoke darkly of hysteria and fear about communism. Tobin denounced slanderers in Congress, undermining the public's trust in government. Though neither had mentioned McCarthy by name, the point was clear. When Tobin mentioned slanderers, one of the VFW organizers had had enough. He leapt from his chair, grabbed the mic out of Tobin's hand, and announced to the crowd that maybe the VFW should let McCarthy speak for himself. The audience roared its approval. McCarthy flew in the next day to address an enthusiastic VFW crowd. For over an hour, he laid into Truman, Acheson, and the whole motley crew. A cheering audience chanted, "Give 'em hell, Joe," and "McCarthy for president." The rote smirking at McCarthy by conservatives is linked to their own psychological compulsion to snobbery. McCarthy was a popularizer, a brawler. Republican elitists abhor demagogic appeals to working-class Democrats. Fighting like a Democrat is a breach of etiquette worse than using the wrong fork. McCarthy is sniffed at for not playing by Marquis of Queensberry rules. Rules of engagement demanded only of Republicans. Lost amid all the mandatory condemnations of Joe McCarthy's name, little detail about his being right always seems to get lost. But McCarthy's fundamental thesis was absolutely correct. The Democratic Party had fallen to the allures of totalitarianism. It was as if Republicans had been caught in bed with Hitler. Liberals would have you believe that Republicans are infinitely susceptible to fascism's lures. But there is no evidence that any American ever connived with Hitler. Though FDR was infatuated with Mussolini and even sent advisors to Italy to take notes on Mussolini's brand of fascism as a model for the National Recovery Act. Even the great aviator Charles Lindbergh, who had once been a Nazi sympathizer, flew combat missions in the Pacific and World War II at an age well beyond expected service years. Conservatives have Charles Lindbergh. Liberals have themselves. Despite the left's creation of a myth to defeat legitimate charges of treason, McCarthy had so badly stigmatized communism, his victory survived him. In his brief fiery ride across the landscape, Joe McCarthy bought America another 30 years. For this, he sacrificed his life, his reputation, his name. The left cut down a brave man, but not before the American people heard the truth. Chapter 5. Victims of McCarthyism, the Liberals' Mayflower. For liberals, McCarthyism was the most significant period in human history, darker than the days of the plague. To hear them tell it, in the 40s and 50s, anyone who read the Village Voice was liable to be hauled before a congressional star chamber and forced to name names, presumably of other Village Voice subscribers. There are stark images of McCarthy pounding his gavel and angry thugs on HUAC denouncing communism and driving innocent people to suicide. Most people who were alive in the 50s have to watch PBS to know it was a frightening period. Liberals simply assert that a certain mood prevailed, and you have to believe it. In a classic account of the fear and suffering wrought by McCarthyism, The San Francisco Chronicle described the horror that befell the children of Soviet spies, such as Robert Maripol, son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. There were phone taps, FBI surveillances, subpoenas, and ostracism. To be sure, their parents were giving atomic technology to the Soviet Union. But the FBI had no right to watch them. Another child victim reported, "The class started to laugh and scream and hoot at me, yelling, 'Commie!'" As the Chronicle reports, "One by one, these testimonies chill us to the bone, making clear what totalitarianism once looked like within our own borders." Here was the stark horror of American totalitarianism. Traitors to their country working on behalf of communist despotism were treated as badly as college Republicans are treated at Amherst College today. Conservatives could never catch up with the outburst of liberal indignation. They didn't care as much as liberals did. No one could. Confronted with hysterical zealots demanding that their view of history be acknowledged, conservatives essentially said, "Fine, if it means that much to you, okay, fine. The human spirit was crushed by Joe McCarthy." The moment you concede some small point to liberals, they go to work building an enormous, elaborate edifice on top of the first lie. In 1965, the Supreme Court invented a privacy right in the Constitution, only as it pertained to the seemingly harmless right of married couples to use contraception. It seemed churlish and hyper-technical to object that there was no such right in the Constitution. 30 years later, that right had transmogrified to a constitutional right to abortion on demand. Conservatives were always annoyed by the idea of the United Nations, bequeathed to us by Soviet spy Alger Hiss. But they resigned themselves to the UN with the hope that, while useless, it couldn't do much harm. The next thing you knew, the UN was dominated by ludicrous despots in countries primarily known for cannibalism, issuing lunatic declarations, while Democrats and the media acted as if UN approval was a constitutional prerequisite to the US acting in its self-defense. Similarly, having ceded the lie of McCarthyism, now no one is allowed to call liberals unpatriotic. Liberals relentlessly attack their own country, but we can't call them traitors, which they manifestly are, because that would be McCarthyism, which never existed. By now, the left's mind-boggling self-righteousness about Senator Joe McCarthy is so overwhelming, so hegemonic, it seems the record could never be set straight. This is the only suffering liberals can point to. The soft existence of cozy environmentalists and Hollywood degenerates doesn't provide much in the way of hardship to bleed about. Safely ensconced in the most affluent and free nation in the history of the world, liberals' biggest pretend fear these days is that anti-choice legislation will somehow sweep the Upper West Side of Manhattan. They haven't really thought through the mechanics of how that would happen. McCarthyism is one of the markers on the left's Via Dolorosa. It is their slavery, their gulag, their potato famine. Otherwise, liberals would just be geeks from Manhattan and Hollywood. The McCarthy myth is the pristine example of how you have to say certain things to be accepted into civilized society. Anyone who fails to issue the ritualistic denunciation of McCarthy must be instantly adjudged a kook, or in the reasoned formulation of McCarthy obsessive and author Richard Revere, zanies and zombies and compulsive haters. It simply must be accepted that Joe McCarthy was a vicious hoodlum with every known human vice. No one knows any facts about McCarthy, but everyone knows that his name is a malediction. Whenever liberals are hysterical about something, but short on details, your antenna should go up. The truth about McCarthy will sound insane, because it has been a major goal of the left to make it sound insane. Your tax money is used to support school textbooks and college professors churning out nonsense about McCarthy. It has been pounded into people that the Red Scare was a weird psychological obsession and that McCarthy was the evil genius behind it. Even people who know better are constantly being forced to